Welcome back to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Information regarding the resources referenced on today's program can be found at www.knowingthetruth.org. Now, here to continue with today's program is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Well, I recently had a press release come across my desk. The headline said this: Personhood USA Presidential Forum asks hard questions of Republican presidential candidates. It's out of Des Moines, Iowa, and dated today, the 28th, December 28th, 2011. It says this: four Republican candidates participated in a pro-life forum Tuesday night answering tough questions about pro-life issues. The National Presidential Pro-Life Forum was the first of its kind, focusing solely on the sanctity of life. The event was sponsored by several prominent pro-life organizations, including Personhood USA, a grassroots Christian organization providing assistance for state groups working to recognize the rights of every human being at every age, and Champion the Vote, an organization committed to actively advancing traditional values, co-sponsored the event, which had over 26,000 participants in a simulcast teletown hall. The forum was hosted by Steve Dace, a nationally syndicated radio host, and broadcast on his Salem Network program and 88 Bot Radio Network radio stations across the country. Joining us now is Steve Dace, that same nationally syndicated radio host. And, Steve, it's a pleasure to have you on the Knowing the Truth radio program.
Thank you very much, Kevin, for having me. I appreciate it.
Steve, wanted to get your thoughts on three different topics. One, first of all, I wanted to get your thoughts on the town hall that you hosted, kind of a postmortem afterwards. How did you think it went? Was there anything surprising to you when you hosted this great event?
I thought it went fairly well. I think it definitely served the process. And I think what's important here is that this is the first, and I think a crucial first step, in a process of Christians ceasing to be anti-abortion and becoming pro-life. And what I mean by that is we have spent, you know, I'm 38 years old. My mom became pregnant with me at 14, and this was right at the time of Roe versus Wade. She chose to have her baby. Other friends of hers that were pregnant out of wedlock did not. And so this is an issue that hits very close to home for me. Also in my own family, I mean, a lot of these pro-life with exceptions Republican candidates would have no problem signing bills into law that would say that members of my own family don't have the inalienable right to life simply because they were not conceived in ideal circumstances. So I think ever since Roe versus Wade, what the church has sought to do in its activism is to regulate abortion. And that means that we've passed a lot of bills that the former Congressman Bob Dornan would say ends with the line, and then you can kill the baby. What we've got to get to is the point now where we are being pro-life. We are asserting the principle of our argument. See, the left asserts the principle of theirs. It's a woman's body. She can do whatever she wants. We need to assert the premise of our argument, which is she cannot do whatever she wants because it's not her body. That's a baby, not her. And I think when we do that, we win. When we argue the premise of the left's argument, that is, some babies really aren't worth protecting, some babies we can sacrifice on the altar of political pragmatism, we're actually arguing their point, and they win. So I think this was very important to get candidates on the record and not just debating each other about who's the most against abortion, who will sign abortion regulation bills, but rather who really is pro-life, meaning is that a baby, is it from God, or is it not?
Well, I wholeheartedly agree with you. I was able to work together with Ligonier Ministries at the end of last year and worked with them to send a copy of R.C. Sproul's book on abortion, which he said is the moral issue of our times. And we sent a copy to every one of the people in Congress at the time. We wanted them to, again, as you were just saying, to look at this from a biblical perspective and not the way that it has migrated towards being looked at in the political arena. There were a couple of interesting things that happened around this issue and around the event that you hosted. One was that I noted that was Rick Perry seems to have changed his view. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Rick Perry was one of these pro-life with exceptions politicians, and again, maybe it's my personal family background. I kind of take exception to those exceptions. So we, on my program, I've always said there's no such thing as pro-life with exceptions. That's like being, I'm pro-marriage fidelity with exceptions, except Thursday nights from 2 to 4 a.m. I mean, that's just crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, if you're pro-life with exceptions, you're really pro-choice. You just want fewer choices than the pro-aborts want.
Mm-hmm.
And Perry was confronted about this with a question that Keith Mason from Personhood USA asked from our town hall audience. And he spoke very passionately, and really it was a compelling moment, frankly, where he talked about an encounter he had recently in Iowa with a woman named Rebecca Kiesling, who is a pro-life attorney, and she is a child that was conceived out of a rape. And she spoke to him one-on-one. He talked in depth about this encounter, how it really changed his heart, and that really led to him signing this pledge. And one of the things that I think, and I said this on my show after the town hall last night, Kevin, I think a lot of men, believing they're noble by saying, when a woman is raped or is a victim of incest, that is such a violation of the most intimate aspects of her femininity. Who am I who cannot walk a mile in her shoes to tell her what she should do in those situations? And I understand where that sense of nobility comes from. And that's why when a woman like Rebecca Kiesling comes up to a Rick Perry and says, hey, I'm one of those exceptions, and it almost gives a person who probably does have a strong pro-life moral conviction, almost it gives him permission to see beyond, am I sexist, am I misogynist, if I tell a woman she has to have this kid, and then it gives him permission to say, you know what, it's back to the original question again. Is that a baby or is it not? And if it is, then I have a sworn duty as an executive the chief executive officer of Texas, as someone that is running to be the chief executive officer of the United States, I have a sworn duty to protect that life.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree, and I think I heard Rick Perry summarize that, where the woman basically said to him, I was a product of a rape, my mother being raped, and she summarized it, or he summarized it, he's retold it as, and my life has value. And so looking her right in the eye, and how could he then say that because the horrible event that took place, the solution to that event is then to cause another horrible event and take the life of an innocent individual? It doesn't make sense at all. And I agree with you that the way it's been positioned. Let me ask you about another interesting thing that has come out of this as well, from Personhood USA, and that is the position of Ron Paul, who I think is still viewed as the leader of the Iowa caucus, leading in most of the polls. But Congressman Paul, who many people say is personally pro-life, has a bit of a conflicting view about federal versus state rights on this issue. Explain that to our listening audience and where we stand on that right now.
The real conflict for Congressman Paul is that he and a lot of his adherents really detest the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. They don't like it. They think it's granted the federal government too much power. It's why in the past they've been on the wrong end of issues like the Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Acts. And it's because they detest the 14th Amendment. They think that essentially it gives the federal government way too much sweeping power to initiate some variation of a police state. And so they're uncomfortable from their view arguing that the 14th Amendment grants the federal government the authority to enforce the inalienable right to life. Now, my reaction to that would be, well, first of all, what does the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution say in the Bill of Rights? It says that no person shall be denied life or property without due process of law. So we're back to the original question again. Is that child in the womb, is that a human person or is it not? Hence the term personhood. So even if they don't like the 14th Amendment, Kevin, they still have to deal, and so does frankly every other politician, still have to deal with the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution. Do we deprive that unborn person of their lives without due process of law? And I would make the argument that no, we do not. And this is also the argument that has been going on in Paul's camp from the beginning, which is what takes precedence, unalienable rights or states' rights? And at times the Paul people act as if amending the U.S. Constitution is like adding a book to the Bible, when in reality, you know, state constitutional amendments cannot pass without input from the states. If we have a constitutional convention, the states send their own electors. If we send the amendments to the states, a supermajority of them has to ratify it. I mean, the idea that amending the U.S. Constitution conflicts with states' rights and federalism. First of all, the people that invented federalism, our founding fathers, were the ones that came up with the amendment process in the first place, so that's self-contradictory. And secondly, it's ironic to hear the people that are arguing for too much government assert that any government has rights. States do not have rights. No government has rights in our system. People, individuals, have rights.
Mm-hmm.
And states have duties and obligations, and the state's duties and obligations is to protect, as our Declaration says, those God-given rights. That's why governments are instituted among men. So no government, as Rick Santorum has said many times, no government has the right to do that which is wrong, whether it's your city commission, county board of supervisors, your state legislature, or the United States Congress. So I think that is the issue for the Paul people, is they're always concerned about encroaching federal power, and I share that concern, but then we as Christians need to understand that the role of government is to be the civil magistrate, to prosecute the natural law, the divine law, and to uphold our God-given rights. So it's not encroachment. This is what I find ironic, is a lot of Paul's people are staunchly right-to-work people. That's another issue I support. So they want a federal right-to-work law. They want a federal law that says no state can force you to join a union if you don't want to. Okay, but we can have a federal right to work law, but we can't have a federal law that says no state can kill babies if they want to. I'm sorry, but as a Christian, that just doesn't make any sense. And that's one of the reasons why Paul struggles to make major inroads with social conservatives.
Yeah, he's launched quite a campaign here in South Carolina to really go after the evangelical vote. He's and most of that is by playing ads that tell just how pro-life he is. And so those ads are running constantly here in South Carolina. But I think that people don't realize that his view is inconsistent with the Christian position on abortion, as you just articulated. It's actually inconsistent with libertarian as well. I read on the Libertarian Party website the other day, it says this concerning abortion. It says, recognizing that abortion is a sensitive issue and that people can hold good faith views on all sides, we believe that the government should be kept out of the matter, leaving the question to each person for their own conscious consideration. Well, that's anathema, obviously, to any Christian conservative, and yet he seems to be trying to straddle this fence between being somewhat pleasing to the libertarians on one side and yet claiming some sort of a Christian mantle on the other side as well. And I think that's becoming a glaring omission on his part, or an inconsistency on his part. Let me ask you a third thing I wanted to ask you. This, the event that you hosted, really highlights, I guess, then Michelle Bachmann, at least with this issue, as being probably the most appealing candidate on the issue of life. Would you agree?
I think she has the most consistent record when you look at how she's voted and who she has endorsed. Rick Santorum's been a champion of the issue his entire career, but you still have to recognize that he has, over the course of his career, in primaries or in general elections, endorsed numerous pro-abort rhinos. I mean, there's just no other way around that. I mean, that's just the truth. But I think the most consistent on the issues, on this issue, and frankly, the issues across the board, has probably been Michelle Bachmann.
Yeah, I thought that really her views get highlighted when this is part of the discussion, which for me, any candidate who is not pro-life, and pro-life in the way that we're talking about, to me, is an immediate disqualification. If your solution is to an unwanted pregnancy that we should take the life of the baby, you have forfeited any reasonableness or common sense whatsoever, and I couldn't trust you with any other issue. So I think that that is vitally important, and I hope it results in a fresh look at the Bachmann candidacy as well. Let me ask you about a second thing. I understand you just released a brand new book called We Won't Get Fooled Again, Where the Christian Right Went Wrong and How to Make It America Right Again. We don't have much time, but let me give you an opportunity to give us a synopsis of what you write about in that book.
What I wrote about in the book is that if you look at the 30 years of Christian political activism within the Republican Party, all of the issues, this is not good news, but if we look at this objectively, all of the issues that we got into the political system to address are all much worse off than they were 30 years ago across the board. And so if God's word does not return to him void, then that's not a him problem, that's an us problem. And we have to consider the means and the methodology by which we've been trying to carry out the word of God. And I think it's pretty clear after interviewing over a dozen religious right leaders for the last 3 years that whether they agreed with us or didn't agree with us, I do think this is pretty clear if you read the book, is that the Christians chose to make a Faustian bargain for a seat at the political party table of the Republican Party, as opposed to driving the issues. And I go to what happened with this Personhood Town Hall last night as a tremendous example. Just 6 weeks ago, the people at Personhood were losing in Mississippi, and the New York Times had a front-page feature quoting other pro-lifers like Jim Bopp at National Right to Life, claiming that Personhood was destroying the pro-life movement. And now, 6 weeks later, here they have a town hall with candidates. They get candidates like Rick Perry to improve their own standard.
Yes.
And how did that work? It worked because they didn't negotiate for a seat at Caesar's table. They said, this is the standard. This is what God compels me to do. As Luther once said, here I stand, I can do no more. May God have mercy on my soul. That it is your duty as the candidate. I'm the boss here. This government begins with we the people. So it is your duty as the candidate to measure up to my standard, which is God's standard. And if you do, I'll support you. And if you don't, I won't. And lo and behold, just like when we do this with our own children, what did these candidates do? They signed this pledge, which is the most pro-life mainstream pledge I have ever seen, and we got them to raise their standard when we put issues above political party and above any other allegiances. Christians are at their best, Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care if it's evangelizing, witnessing, discipling, whatever aspect it is of the Christian walk, we are at our best when we stand for a transcendent absolute truth and compel the system to raise its standard to ours or respond to it, as opposed to when we take a look at two flawed paradigms and say, hey, which of these two can I most contort my own faith into enough of a pretzel to justify being a part of the groupthink?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we did that for 30 years, and we lost. And I think this Personhood USA town hall we had last night and the approach that was taken, to me, is an archetype of what we need to do in the future, which is, this isn't about a seat at the table. I don't need to come to your banquets. I don't want to hear your speakers. I've got my own family. God's got other things for me to do. I don't need this to be like high school where I feel like I'm involved and I'm one of the popular kids. What I need you to do is honor your oath of office and keep your promises to me as my elected representative. And if you do, you're going to love me. And if you don't, I'm going to fire you. I mean, that's really what we've got to get back to.
Practically speaking, in the actual races that are taking now, does that flesh itself out as being more actively involved in the primary process?
Yes.
And what does it look like after the primary is over? Most people then use this commonly used phrase, well, we have to select the lesser of two evils. What does that look like in both the primary process and afterwards?
Well, those are two salient questions, and they go right to the action points at the end of our book, the conclusion. And to me, the primary becomes the election now for Christians, Kevin. I think that is the election. I think depending on who wins primaries really determines whether the general election ultimately matters or not. I know there are people listening right now, and some folks, and I run into this here in Iowa and around the country where I broadcast. Some Christians act as if being a Republican is like being a Baptist, okay? I'm sorry, but that's just not true. I mean, I'm not going to give an account to the chairman of the Republican National Committee when my time on earth is at an end.
Yes.
And I think that we have got to get involved in primaries, and the primary cannot be about who can win. It needs to be about who should win.
Mm-hmm.
That's the question we need to be asking ourselves. And we need to fight like crazy in these primaries, because I don't think any Christian can argue with me that we have a substantially more righteous government under George W. Bush than we did under Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, I hate to say this, Bill Clinton's second term with the Republican Congress was one of the most conservative presidential terms we've had since probably pre-Great Depression.
Mm.
Welfare reform, the Defense of Marriage Act, the crime bill, I mean, those are some pretty conservative reforms that we had under President Clinton with Speaker Gingrich and Majority Leader Dole working against and for one another.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we've got to critically think this, get very involved in primaries, and then if your person doesn't win in the general election, then I think it's up to every Christian to act on their own moral conscience.
Mm-hmm.
I think then if you can find, and I think when we argue how much evil can I accept, we've already lost.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, the argument needs to be Christians are to advance righteousness, not regulate evil or minimize evil. So the question then becomes, who provides me the most opportunity to stand for righteousness where God has me in my life? And I think if we made arguments from positive constructs as opposed to negative constructs, then I think that we would do better. And again, I go back to this personhood town hall. We said, hey, here's the positive. You guys all say you're for life at conception. Now prove it to us. Here's what it looks like. Show us that you really mean it. And we compelled them, instead of saying, hey, you know what, you'll kill a few less kids than Barack Obama will, so that's just good enough for us. No, we said it's not, the standard isn't you versus Barack Obama. The standard is you versus the laws of nature and nature's God. That is the standard. You don't swear an oath to be better than Barack Obama. You swear an oath to uphold your oath of office before God. And I think that's what Christians need to get back to, is standing for transcendent standards. And also I would say this. If somebody like Mitt Romney wins the nomination, then I don't think you have a moral obligation. I've got to, like zombie Republicans, I've got to vote Republican. To me, he has to sell you as a voter, just like he has to sell every other undecided voter. We don't have any king but Jesus. We have no allegiances ultimately but to Jesus. And the great irony of this is when Christians in history have lived that way, they've gotten, Kevin, as you well know if you know your church history, we've gotten more out of the system living that way than we ever have playing nice with the system.
Exactly. You know, Calvin actually spoke about being in politics with that type of view in mind as being one of the highest callings that a man could hold. And so we've lost sight of that, of course, and really have just capitulated on a number of things. I got to let you go, Steve. I know you've got another interview up, but what happens if Ron Paul wins?
I think if Ron Paul wins, then I think it really matters who finishes third. And I think we'll punch at least three tickets out of Iowa. Your state, South Carolina, will become really the default line, and it will be Ron Paul and the sort of hybrid libertarian, constitutionalist versus the milquetoast establishment candidate in Romney. And whoever that third candidate is will sort of be the conservative grassroots alternative. And I think those three will square off in your state. What we don't know is who that third candidate's going to be. We'll find out January 3rd.
Great. Well, I'd love to have you back on as we get when we get here, looking primarily here at South Carolina. But Steve, thank you very much. Thank you for the work that you're doing there in Iowa, and thank you for taking the time out of your very busy schedule, I'm sure, this week to visit with us here on the Knowing the Truth radio program.
You're welcome. We love being on your radio station, and thanks for the time.
You've been listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Boling. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Travelers Rest. For more information about the church and radio ministry, visit us on the web at knowingthetruth.org.